Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forsees. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin. And once again, we're in the observation room at our court room at the University of Ottawa Law School.
We're near the canal, but not the Rideau River.
That's right. We can never get back to the Rideau River these days, in part because of the
ongoing labor dispute.
Ongoing labor dispute at Carleton University. Hopefully, we'll get back there before the summer. And so today, Stephanie, what are we talking about?
We're going to talk about something that we keep saying we're going to talk about and then finally have gotten around to, which is the Investment Canada Act and some of the national security implications.
Oh, be still my beating heart.
I know. There you go. Yeah. You know why I'm so excited about this? I'm excited because we don't talk in this country about the relationship between our economy and national security. You know, and there's a good reason for that. And that's because, you know, us being a capitalist society, we want to get the state out of the economy, right? Like, that's the last thing that you want. Whereas national security is all about getting the state up in your business. So, you know, the two don't necessarily go hand in hand very well. But other countries have actually turned their economic instruments and companies and corporations into tools for national security. Now, these aren't the kind of liberal democratic societies that, you know, we have here in the West, but, you know, I'm thinking of Russia to a certain extent, China and some other countries as well. But how do we square the circle on the economy and national security? It's a really, I think, important question. We're not going to answer that today, but I think talking about the Investment Canada Act will actually go some way towards addressing this, I think, issue that we've just really not discussed.
Yeah, and at the back end too, we'll have a chance to talk about circumstances where one doth protest too much about national security and economic interests, and that would be the whole issue about the use of a national security exemption to impose tariffs, say hypothetically, on steel and aluminum. Of course, this was a discussion generated by the Trump administration's decision to do just that, tied to a national security exemption under the WTO regime. And so, does that work? Can that be done? And that's a question we'll have to engage at the back end of this podcast.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. All right. So a couple of things from the headlines, right, to get us going here. And so Robert Fife and Steve Chase in the Globe and Mail, March 25th, so just a few days ago, former CSIS director Ward Elcock says the Aecon sale to China is not in Canada's strategic interest. And they go on to say, former CSIS director Ward Elcock says the takeover of Canadian infrastructure giant Aecon Group by a Chinese state-owned firm is not in the country's strategic interests, even if a national security review approves or places conditions on the $1.5 billion transaction. Well, here's another story from March 19th. Former top Canadian security officials warn Ottawa to sever links with China's, help me here, how do you pronounce this?
Huawei.
There's actually a very amusing YouTube video where people are asked how to pronounce that word, and I'm obviously a fodder for that. Huawei. So three former directors of Canada's key national security agencies are urging the federal government to heed the warnings of U.S. intelligence services and cut Canadian ties with Huawei, the giant Chinese smartphone and telecommunication equipment maker. And that's not the only example, right, Stephanie? Over the last couple of years, where have we seen other examples? Now, the government keeps close to its chest these national security investment issues, but there are other examples that have come up and popped up in the press. 2012, Allstream, which was a Winnipeg-based telecommunications company, was on the block, possibly being sold to an Egyptian company, and so that was raised some controversy. A firm called Maple Armor Fire Solutions Canada.
Sounds very Canadian.
Right. Well, it was a Chinese firm that was supposed to build fire alarm systems for the Chinese market, and the controversy and the decision behind what was then a national security review conducted by the Canadian government, which rejected apparently the location of the factory too close to the headquarters of the Canadian Space Agency, just 2 kilometers away in Montreal. And then, of course, during the BlackBerry era back in 2013, there were rumors that Lenovo Group in China would acquire BlackBerry, and Prime Minister Harper at the time made some stern warnings that this would be closely scrutinized. And so these are recurring issues.
Yeah, I mean, like most famously CNOOC when it took over Nexen. That was the state-owned enterprise. So I think the issue here is like, so is this just discrimination? Is this just because China's bad? No, I mean, there's a reason why security services have concerns about certain state-owned enterprises from certain countries.
Yeah.
And that is that basically state-owned enterprises are seen as instruments of statecraft. And China is not, you know, hiding that. there's something like 150,000 in China alone. And that's, you know, just state-owned. That's just kind of like the big ones. And, you know, there's some trends here. We know that the state-owned enterprises are actually merging together. They're becoming larger. There's some concerns that they're actually becoming less efficient as a result. But we also know President Xi, now President Xi for life, because he's just changed the constitution basically to allow him to stay in power forever, that basically he views state-owned enterprises as, in his words, national champions. And he sees them as helping to achieve the economic goals of China, which in the economic goal of China is basically to supplant the West in manufacturing. So this is why there's concern that, you know, that basically state-owned enterprises are being used in kind of a clandestine, you know, it's an open way. You're buying it. You're going through the front door. But if your ultimate goal is to basically undermine Canadian industry through making these purchases, through either, you know, because when you buy these companies, you get access to their intellectual property, you get access to kind of all their data, their information. You can undercut your competitors domestically. So you can, you know, one of the concerns with Huawei is they're so much cheaper than everyone else, which, you know, Canadian business loves. But you know,
and now is embedded in your telecommunications.
But it's now embedded in your telecommunications, exactly. Yeah. And not only that, but all of your domestic kind of telecommunications companies then also go out of business. So there's a lot of bad things that can happen. Now, the question is, are those national security issues?
Right.
And it's not, I mean, for me, I would say,
how do you define national security?
Exactly. Right. And so, you know, this is kind of the issue, which I think kind of we can talk about the Investment Canada Act and where all that came from.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Investment Canada Act is got into the idea of national security reviews relatively recently. So actually these date to 2009, the system for national security reviews. Did you want to talk a little bit about the history?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, well, the first kind of reviews were done in the 1970s, but the fear wasn't China back then. It was the United States. There was a real fear that Canada was going to become what was, I think, believed then called a branch plant economy, where basically we'd be run essentially by the United States. So in 1974, the Pierre Trudeau pair, passed the Foreign Investment Review Act. And basically all new foreign acquisitions and establishments of business in Canada above a certain size were required to undergo review. And they were approved on whether they were, quote, of significant benefit
to
Canada.
Right, a net benefit analysis.
Yeah. Right. So that was kind of the first stance to that. So then this was changed by Brian Mulroney, who won, you know, his attitude was, of course, that, you know, foreign investment is good and good for Canada. So he changed it to the Investment Canada Act in 1985. And that was changed basically to reflect the government's view that foreign investment was basically, again, a net positive. And instead of the kind of significant benefit test, the new Investment Canada Act introduced a competitiveness incompatible with federal government or federal provincial cultural policies. So that was the major difference there. Now, importantly, at this point, none of this distinguished between a state-owned enterprise and a company, because that really wasn't that big
of an issue. And there wasn't
a
specific national security scrutiny.
Exactly. Right. There was not. So it really, I mean, so this is kind of what is the lead into you know, as we start seeing really after, I would say that by the mid 1990s through the 2000s, we see a huge uptick in investment from China in Canada. But, you know, with things that especially such as Nexen and other things like that, we do start to see some concerns starting in 2009. So do you want to go from 2009?
Yeah, so 2009, so the Investment Canada Act, whose origins you described, it's amended and it creates a special national security review process, which at the time actually remained fairly opaque. And so basically, the way it works, non-Canadians who acquire control of an existing Canadian business or who wish to establish a new Canadian business are subject to review under the Act. And so they have to submit what's known either as a notification or an application for review. And thereafter, an investment may be subject to a national security review, and so a special national security focused review, if the Minister of Innovation, Science and Economic Development, in consultation with the Minister of Public Safety, considers the investment could be injurious to national security. And so there's a 45-day vetting process that can be extended by another 45 days, after which, if the minister so concludes, it goes to the Governor Council, that is the federal cabinet, and the cabinet can order a full review for national security. Now, there was no definition in the Act of National Security, and so this opaque concept, and incidentally, that's not unusual. One of the first things I did when I got into this business is I went through every statute in Canadian law that used the term national security or close analogs, and I looked at how many had definitions, and only about a third define the concept of national security, which is a bit concerning because it tends to be this concept that's in the eyes of the beholder. And so this would be an example of an instrument that had no formal definition. But in 2016, finally, we had guidelines issued
Okay.
And the guidelines describe really what's intended by national security, at least in broad terms.
So basically, the other thing that happened was in 2012, there was concern again that China was kind of buying up all of our oil patches. And this is important, again, because I think the other issue here is that Canada spent a lot of the 1980s denationalizing its companies. And we were in a situation where we're seeing our companies renationalize again, except it's not Canadian companies, it's foreign companies. And that's a bit of an issue. So basically, in the aftermath of the CNOOC, which is the Chinese National Overseas Oil Corporation, in the Nexen deal, that the Harper government came out with clarifying for the Canadian context that there was going to be a couple of tests. And, you know, Harper basically came out and said that foreign SOEs are inherently susceptible to foreign government influence and therefore inconsistent with Canadian national industrial and economic objectives. And secondly, that, you know, there could be adverse effects. And then thirdly, they believe that, you know, there might be some concern about the kind of economic playing field generally. Basically, Harper declared that each case would now be examined on its own merit, right. And that given the inherent risks posed by these SOEs. And so it was a real kind of tightening up of the policy in 2012. But again, I think one of the major concerns in 2012 is that the grounds upon which a national security review were actually brought up were never really specified.
Yeah, so you had to wait till 2016, right?
Right.
So in 2016, we get these guidelines on national security review. And so it starts with a sort of this broad preambular statement. So the review will be guided by the nature of the asset or business activities and the parties, right? And so what's on the block and who's buying it, including the potential for third-party influence. Gee, I wonder what that means, right? Governments, basically.
Yeah.
Third-party governments involved in the transaction.
It's not your neighbors.
Right, exactly. And so then they go through and they list 9 factors that in their view comprise national security. It's not an exclusive list, and so other things could be on this list, but it's a pretty broadly textured list. Some of it is quite intuitive. So the potential effects of the investments on defense capabilities and interests, transfer of sensitive technology, the impact on security of Canada's critical infrastructure, foreign surveillance and espionage. And then there's more broadly textured considerations, potential impact of the investment on Canada's international interests, including foreign relationships, a fairly open textured concept. And so there's a fair range that the government has to decide what to do with a foreign investment, because at the back end of this review, once the Governor Council orders this review, they can oblige a divestiture. And so they can oblige the foreign investor to sell their interest. They can authorize the investment on conditions, or they could block the investment in the first place. And so there's substantial powers the government has to manage the foreign investment environment. Now, one of the things that's true, and I don't know if you have better information than I do, but if you read the legal literature in this area, and so this is actually big business, right? Big firms, big corporate law firms are involved in this, and they put out these brochures and newsletters and the like and get quite invested in this area. And one of the concerns has been that there hasn't been a lot of transparency about how these reviews are conducted or even which review is being undertaken. In fact, we really know about these reviews because the entity that's being reviewed told everyone. It's not the government itself that's reporting on the specifics of the review. And so the government's really kept secret the facts surrounding the investments that have been subject to national security reviews. And so in consequence, we don't really have a good sense of what's going on. But Fasken Martineau, which is a big Bay Street firm, through the Access to Information Act, managed to extract some interesting data, some statistics. And so from March 2009 to March 2016, there were 4,359 notifications and 112 applications for review. That's the initial stage, filed for the Investment Canada Act. Of those, between 2012 and 2017, there have been 13 national security reviews. And so that's a really small fraction. 13 national security reviews out of what? Basically 4,500 cases of investment. That's a really small fraction. Of those 13, there have been 3 investments blocked, 5 divestitures ordered, and 4 in which conditions were imposed. And that data actually is drawn from the most recent Investment Canada annual report. And so you got to ask, and actually you find a division of opinion if you read this literature. Some people in the business say this is an incredibly aggressive regime Canada has in terms of managing investment, and it's a deterrent for foreign investors, and it's really a bad thing because it dries up capital that would otherwise be available for Canadian firms, and everyone's got overboard. And that's probably a critique directed at Investment Canada Act generally, and not just the National Security Review. And then others say, you know, Canada's just not stepping to the plate, given how unusual these national security reviews are and how infrequent they are. And that there's not enough regulatory effort being made to scrutinize these pressing investments by, amongst other state-owned enterprises, but presumably others as well. And so it's hard to say as an outsider exactly who has the merit of that argument, but it's certainly an issue that probably deserves more scrutiny, in not just in relation to these high-profile investments, but from a policy perspective. And maybe that's a job for the National Security Intelligence Review Committee of Parliament.
Oh, there we go.
Right, who can have access to classified information and a better sense as to how well this regime's working.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to really talk about this because, you know, as you say, there's not a lot of publicly available information about this process. But I think the other thing here, too, is that the, you know, all this, all these decisions are recommendations. You know, they don't. I don't think they actually, the committee decides. I think they offer a recommendation to the government, and the government then can choose to accept the advice.
Yeah, so it's the governor and council that makes, the cabinet makes the decision.
Yes. Right. So, that's, and that's just it. So this isn't like some kind of...
Made at a political level.
Yeah, so it is made at a political level, and they choose to accept or go away from the consequences.
Right. Right, and so you're seeing certainly some toing and froing between former intelligence officials and the government at present about these companies that we mentioned at the outset.
I think, but I mean, like, this is the issue. So it's like, if you know you have states, and it's not just China, by the way. Like, we talk about China because it's the public face, but there's also concern about, like, Russia, because Russia has, you know, certain laws about, if it's a Russian company, it's a Russian telecommunications company, they actually have to report their data or make their data available to the Russian intelligence services, to the Russian government. So it's like there's concerns there about the safety and security of data, frankly. So you want to be really careful. Now, there's so many sanctions on Russia and there's so little investment between our two countries that it doesn't come up very often. But it's not just China that you actually worry about. I think that there's also... but there's also concerns here, too. It's like, and a lot of this plays into the kind of free trade talk that we've seen between Canada and China. And, you know, if anyone follows me on Twitter, they know I'm a maniac about this, that I'm very anti-free trade agreement with China. I just don't see, the issue is we put the laws in place. And one of the concerns is that once we put the laws in place, that... And if those laws are published, if we made this process public, if we explain to China, okay, these are our rules, they'll find ways to work around those rules. Because that's how China works. I mean, that's just what they do. So it's like, okay, well, these are the rules. You know, say, okay, so if basically we will trigger some kind of investment if or some kind of review if the investment is over 50%. Then they're going to invest at 49.9 and then find another partner to work with in order to get another 2%. And then that's how that investment's basically going to work. Yeah. So they'll find ways to work around the system. They're very clever. And my concern is, like, you know, they're not, the issue with state-owned enterprises, they're not like other entities, right? The if you have the resources of a state behind you, you're inherently uncompetitive in a market. And there's a concern that you then skew the economic landscape. So the question is, how do you take that into consideration through a national security review process? Or how do you take the risk of, like, say, a state-owned enterprise, they come in, we figure that, you know, they're not doing something the way we want them to. Well, advocates of state-owned enterprises will say, you know, well, they're subject to Canadian law.
Right.
Right? So that they are actually... you know, we shouldn't worry about them. They're subject to Canadian law. But, you know, state-owned enterprises won't retaliate like a normal company, right? Like, if you, let's say we retaliate against Huawei for some reason. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, there's a major health and safety issue with canola in China.
Right.
And Canadian canola specifically. You know, that's how these things work. That's how the retaliation works. So the problem is, when you're dealing with these entities, it's not like your run-of-the-mill companies. So this is just it. Do we want to give the Chinese state access to all of our critical infrastructure? Do we want, or not all of it, a chunk of it, and important, or our nuclear power plants or things like this? Because there is an inherent risk here, but it's hard to quantify. Unlike terrorism, which is kind of like, okay, bad guy goes loose, boom goes off, we're in a lot of trouble. This is actually a substantially more
amorphous
gray issue that we have to kind of wrestle with, and we have to kind of figure out, okay, well, just how much of this investment from an increasingly authoritarian country that's willing to kind of show its muscle in the South China Sea and elsewhere, how much of this do we actually want in Canada?
Yeah. Well, it circles back to the preoccupation with economic sovereignty that generated the initial, the predecessors of the Canada Investment Act. I mean, the other thing, too, of course.
I'm kind of nostalgic for those days at
this point. Well, we may be coming back to them. I actually have a point at the back end when we talk about our trade law about the prospect of the Iran deal falling apart and what it might mean in terms of sort of back to the future blocking legislation in Canada. But the technology transfer issue is a real one, too, right? And so if you've got a state-owned enterprise, how useful are firewalls that you might put in place via contract? So what do we do? Can we actually protect that information and keep it firewalled through contract, which you might expect in a private sector enterprise, but might be much more difficult in state-owned enterprise? And I would add, in an integrated defense economy like we have the United States, where we have to be very concerned about the extraterritorial reach of American export control rules that extend not just to the products that might cross the border, but also the know-how. To the extent our industrial infrastructure starts implicating foreign actors who may be subjected to American sanctions law, it degrades our capacity to participate with American firms, which incidentally is probably the reason why we see this reference in the guidelines to potential impacts of the investment on Canada's international interests, including foreign relationships. So we have to be very concerned about not being far afield the United States because of the degree of integration between our sensitive sectors.
Well, didn't we see that last year with the NORSAT sale? Yeah. The sale that, you know, there's concern that, you know, there's satellite technology here that could be used in a way that would be harmful to Western security interests. But the government went through with the sale anyways.
Yeah. And this is always a delicate balance because the American
I don't think the Americans were particularly happy about it.
No, not at all. And the American sanctions laws are vast in terms of the entities to which they apply and deeply extraterritorial, and it's very difficult for us to manage that. And so to the extent that it becomes more complicated because of the investment environment in Canada, I imagine that's a bit of a nightmare for public policymakers. Should we segue now to a conversation about pure trade law? Is there anything more we want to say?
You know what? There is nothing I love better than pure trade law.
Pure trade law.
I just get up and put up some trade law.
No day goes by without a conversation about the GATT, right, and the World Trade Organization. So, and the genesis for this conversation and the reason that we're talking about it in the national security context is, of course, U.S. Department of Commerce, two months ago, concluded that steel and aluminum imports threatened to impair the national security of the United States. And they recommended a range of remedies to the president, and ultimately Trump levied 25% tariffs on steel and 10% charge on aluminum. Now, there are carve-outs, right? So there are temporary exclusions for Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Mexico, and the member countries of the EU, as well as South Korea. And then there's also the prospect that individual companies can seek exclusions from the tariff regime, and there's a whole big complicated process.
It seems like a big piece of Swiss cheese.
It is a big piece of Swiss cheese, and I have to say, having gone through the last time the Americans did this with steel, which was in, 2002 with the safeguards regime under the Bush administration, I was in private practice then as a trade lawyer in Washington, it's like full employment for lawyers, right? Because every company is trying to get a carve-out for their given product, and so all these different steel products are seeking their own little exemptions, and it's a full-on negotiated bureaucratic process that sometimes results in litigation with the Department of Commerce. It is absolutely a billing paradise. And so that's the problem with managed trade, by the way. Managed trade, as best I can tell, only enriches lawyers. The issue for us, I suppose, at this juncture is, how can the Americans, can they legitimately say under the international trade law regime that tariffs of this sort can be legitimated on a national security ground? And the answer is yes. And this is actually, and I'm going to circle back to this is actually quite concerning from the sustainability of the open trading system.
And so the
answer, yes, the technical answer, legal answer of yes, stems from Article 21 of the GATT. And so the GATT is this ancient precursor of the World Trade Organization.
General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade.
Correct, which dates from the late 1940s and is embedded also in the WTO framework, which dates from 1994. And the carve-out in Article 21 says that nothing in the regular trade law rules prevents a party from taking any action which it considers necessary for the protection of its essential security interests, one, relating to fissionable materials, right, so bomb stuff, 2, relating to the traffic in arms and ammunition and implements of war. And 3, taken in times of war or other emergencies in international relations. And so you might look at that list and say, well, you know, we can add some definitional precision to that. And are the Americans really acting pursuant to the standards articulated in Article 21? To which my response would be, doesn't matter. Why? Because Article 21 is one of these self-defining exceptions. And so if you look at the literature, it's described as self-judging, unreviewable, loophole, a trump card, a term actually used before Donald Trump assumed office.
Yeah. Right?
So it's this ambiguous language that preserves the sovereign capacity of states to declare essentially a matter of national security and exempt themselves from the regular discipline of international trade law.
And I think we need to be clear here. I mean, like, look, I ain't no lawyer, and I certainly didn't work as a lawyer in Washington. But the president has considerable authority to define what a national security threat is, right?
Under U.S. law, because it's been delegated to him by Congress, and we're not going to try to review the U.S. law. Steve Vladeck and Bobby Chesney did an assessment of this.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
So we're not going to try to rehearse the American side of the agenda. So just to focus on the international side. So I'll give you my favorite example of a state using this Article 21. So 1975, Sweden.
It's always the Swedes.
It's all the Swedes, right? Sweden introduces a global import quota system for certain footwear, basically boots. And this is what they said. That they said that this was in conformity with the national security carve-out in Article 21 because the decrease in domestic production of boots has become a critical threat to the emergency planning of Sweden's economic defense as an integral part of the country's security policy. This policy necessitates the maintenance of a minimum domestic production capacity in vital industries. Such a capacity is indispensable in order to secure the provision of essential products necessary to meet basic needs in case of war or other emergencies in international relations, i.e., you can never send an army to fight without their boots, right?
It's true. It'd be hard.
And so the issue is, well, that's just ridiculous, right? That's obviously disguised protectionism for the Swedish footwear manufacturing industry. Bottom line is, you can't touch it, right? It's self-declaratory. And so one of the issues is, well, could you ever take this to the WTO dispute settlement bodies? And if you did, would you have any chance of success? I think the considered judgment of most people is, well, first of all, it's never gone to dispute settlement. And here's an actual a good description. This is from Michael Woods, who's a trade lawyer here in Ottawa. He's a recent blog on this issue. He says, unlike in relation to other exceptions that have been found in trade law agreements, Article 21 has never been taken to the WTO dispute settlement system. Why? Because there's a reluctance on the part of sovereign governments to allow their judgment of what they deem to be in their country's security interest to become subject to review by another body, that is the WTO. So this is natural reticence. The fear, though, is that if you invoke Article 21 liberally, it'll become a slippery slope. That
right.
is, if one state does it, another state will do it, and you'll end up with the unraveling of the international trade law regime. And that is a view that's widely shared as well. There's sort of a diplomatic understanding that you're going to be judicious in using Article 21, notwithstanding that Swedish example. The fact is that we don't have a lot of examples of Article 21 being invoked, notwithstanding the fact that it's been on the books for the better part of 70 years. And so now to see the Americans turning around and using it in these circumstances, the risk is that will signal to other states that they're free to play fast and loose with other rather dubious Article 21 justifications, and you'll end up with a slide to an ungoverned international trade regime, and that the carve-out in Article 21 will swallow the entire international trade law system.
But I think, this is the breaking news as of this week, which was that the federal government basically said on Tuesday that it's going to basically now also crack down on cheap metals. And it's going to give the authority to the CBSA to identify and stop companies that are trying to dodge U.S. duties by slightly modifying products or assembling them in Canada and then shipping them elsewhere.
Well, that's the knock-on effect. Those are safeguards regimes. So as soon as someone slaps on tariffs in one country, the concern is that you'll end up with that product being dumped in other countries because that first country's market dries up. And so the result is that other countries will have to match at some level the American tariffs or risk having Chinese product or product from other manufacturers of steel dumped on their market. There are special rules for safeguards regimes that don't require Article 21 invocation. And there's always the prospect of using the regular rules on dumping, which is basically selling your product in the foreign market at a cost that, in the case of China, is the way it works for a non-market economy is the way it works is to say that you're selling your product for less than the cost of production in China.
And so possibly because you're a state-owned enterprise unlimited.
And there's no market signals within your economy by which you can actually establish fair market price. So it's predatory pricing in order to destroy the local producers, and then of course you would jack up your prices. But so there are regular regimes in place like anti-dumping, but that's not what the Americans did in relation to the aluminum and steel tariffs. They justified it in Article 21, and so the fear is that that's just going to be Pandora's box, because now other states will feel empowered to use this absolutely self-declaratory, ambiguous, unjudiciable standards to justify their own protectionism, and that's a real concern. And so I guess I would put this in the column of norm-busting activities by the current administration in the United States that in the long run probably risks doing more damage to the U.S. than benefit.
I agree. And not only that, it's like, you know, but this gets back to the, and again, we always say, you know, the U.S. is not our concern. That's sometimes we end up talking about the U.S. But the concern that we have when Trump came in is that he's really upending the global trade. And we are a trading nation. Like if Trump ends up, if he upends the WTO and things like that, like we're stuffed. Like this is bad. This is really bad for Canada. So, one of the things that we see with Trump is that he kind of says, we're going to do this. And then everyone freaks out. And then you find out there's it's a very weak policy, or there's 800 exceptions, or, you know, these kinds of things to stop it.
Never
or
quite
that
sure
it's
what's
done.
Happened.
Or it's done so ham fistedly that, you know, the court throws it out within a day.
Yeah.
So it's kind of.
But he's getting his sea legs. So these are things that are very hard to challenge. It would be impossible to challenge this in U.S. domestic law, and it would be essentially, as I've suggested, impossible to challenge at the WTO, right? And so this is a little bit different from the painful rollout of the travel ban at the outset of the Trump administration, which was just inevitably going to end up in court. These are truly
presidential powers with the national security.
Yeah, these are the flexings of this is the flexing of muscle that the president really does have. And in the past, the constraint has been the prospect that it would cut off your nose to spite your face if you were to start using these measures to justify your own protectionism because of the consequences in terms of what other states would do. Can I just raise one other thing? Because this is our trade law day, right? And so, you know, of course, you and I and others were deep in our cups last week because John Bolton is going to be the new national security advisor. And so we're all going to go out and run out and get our emergency supplies this weekend. But
it's getprepared.gc.ca. Right. That's the website.
So, of course, the prediction at this point is that the Iran deal is dead. So this is the deal between the United States, the European allies in Iran that has the effect of suspending Iran's efforts to refine uranium, with the long-term expectation that they were seeking to acquire the bomb. And so if that deal goes on the U.S. side, I don't know that we should expect that other states would necessarily also abandon the deal. So we may end up with the Americans trying to reimpose economic sanctions on Iran outside the multilateral venue in which they were imposed in the past. And so at issue would be American unilateralism. In the past, when you've had unilateral economic sanctions by the Americans, there's been a lot of concern on the part of other economies that because of the very aggressive extraterritorial reach of these American sanctions that European and Canadian and other companies will start complying with the American sanctions regime because they don't want to be subjected to penalties within the very important U.S. market because they have assets in the U.S. or what have you. And so in the past, in relation, say, to you know, Cuba with Helms-Burton and other American extraterritorial.
And by that you mean those extraterritorial laws are laws which basically are in the U.S. that punish a foreign state for its otherwise
activities. Well, punish a foreign company for activities outside of the territorial jurisdiction of the United States
for doing something that it wouldn't want to do.
And so long as that company has assets or a presence in the U.S., they can be subject to the American enforcement jurisdiction.
And Helms-Burton, say for example, that particularly targeted Cuba.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in the past, what we've used is Europeans and Canadians have used blocking legislation. And so basically blocking legislation says, if you comply with the American law, you violate Canadian law. And so you choose.
We're going to lose that.
Well, no, we've used it in the past, right?
Has it worked?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. But of course, it's enormously painful as a process. because now you're saying to your companies, you got a choice here. You're gonna be on the hook one way or another. It's very disruptive of the international economic trading arrangement and investment regime.
But so, that being said, I don't see Canada resuming economic ties with Iran or having Canadian businesses doing a lot of ties with Iran anytime soon because Canada has its own very strict sanctions independent of any agreement.
But possibly, although I think we've relaxed our Iranian sanctions relative to what they were before the Iranian agreement. And certainly from the European perspective, the Europeans have been reinvested in Iran, is the way I understand.
Oh, no, they've gone completely, yeah. No, they've gone whole hog, but I think in Canada.
So the bottom line is, if this happens, so people have been talking about the implications from a security perspective of the Iranian agreement falling to pieces, and then all of a sudden we're left with Iran, which is fully now presumably going to re-engage in its nuclearization.
It's going to have monetary ties and a new nuclear program.
Right, but then in terms of relationship with the allies, even if, so there's a couple of issues in terms of relationship with the allies. If the Americans decide that's it, we're going to do preemptive strikes, I don't expect many allies to go along with that. So that's on the military side. On the economic side, though, if the Americans are insistent on imposing really strict new sanctions and try to extend them extraterritorially, then you're going to have all sorts of economic conundrums, because I fully expect that other states will then introduce blocking legislation, as has happened in the past. So I may be wrong on that, but you know, it's something to watch for if this whole thing falls apart.
Right. Well, that's a nice note to end on before Easter.
Yeah,
for those celebrating.
I think it's important always to have a little bit of doom and gloom at the back end of any podcast.
It's like running out of chocolate. It's not being able to find all the eggs.
All right, well, that's it for today. That's all the time we have for today. And thanks very much to everyone. And we're back for the next couple of weeks. At least our plan is to be back for the next couple of weeks with a further set of pod sites from visitors. And so we hope that you enjoy those, and we look forward to doing them. Thanks very much, everyone.
See you next time.